failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies. Welcome to this special edition of Century of Lies. We're going to take a look back at the year 2005. Century of Lies did not hit the airwaves until May 15th, when our first guest, Jack Cole, the Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP.cc, was our guest.
Well, I'm a retired detective lieutenant from the New Jersey State Police, 26 years there. For 14 of those years, I worked in Narcotic Bureau, mainly undercover, doing everything from street-level drug deals up to billion-dollar international heroin and cocaine traffic conspiracy rings.
Well, Jack, in those years, it was your job to basically to fool people, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
Let's talk about that, setting people up for the big fall. How does that work?
It's not the... Being an undercover person isn't the romantic thing that you would imagine from watching television or the movies. It's really a pretty despicable job. You see, my job was to be targeted against an individual, and as soon as I received the information on who that target was supposed to be, my job became do whatever is necessary to become that person's closest friend, their best confidant, so that I could betray them. And as soon as I finished with that person, I was targeted against another one. It was just over and over again. Friendship, betrayal, prison.
It's, yes, despicable indeed, I must say. Now, considering you were just one cog in one wheel, that happens 1.6 million times a year. Is that right?
No, those aren't all undercover.
But thousands, if not hundreds of thousands.
Well, certainly. And certainly we are taking 1,600,000 people every year that we are arresting for nonviolent drug offenses every single year. And those lives, if they're not destroyed, they are certainly crippled. And we have a saying, a leap, you can get over an addiction, you will never get over a conviction. That's because a conviction will follow you every day for the rest of your life. It's on a computer. It doesn't matter if you move to another country. It's right there every time you go to get a job. It's over your head like this big, ugly cloud. And if you're a young person in our country and you want to, say, go back to school and better your lot in life, you've been caught with so much as a marijuana cigarette, you discover that you can no longer get a grant or loan from the government to go to school. We're pretty harsh with the people we arrest for drugs.
Well, yes, sir. It's all designed to supposedly teach a lesson, if you will, that they won't ever do it again, and this will learn them, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. That's that's what we're pretty good at, punishment in this country.
We had a pretty good shake-up of the program schedule here at the mothership, and Century of Lies fell off the grid until August 12th, when our guest was Sylvan Reynolds, the president of the Pain Relief Network. Now, on a daily basis, we see the stories of how the DEA or local law enforcement officials go after people for taking pain medications, and they go after the doctors and the pharmacists now for prescribing those drugs. Talk about just the general situation.
Well, the situation's bad. I mean, what happened was, in the late 90s, medicine moved forward, not realizing that there was a federal push against the adequate treatment of pain in the United States. So the doctors went ahead and started saying, oh, you know, everybody should get their pain treated, and the medical boards are the people that actually run the regulation of medicine. That's what the Constitution says, so we can go ahead and do that, and we'll just change the way things are going. We'll make it less punitive, and we'll make sure that doctors document what they're doing and all that, but we will insist that doctors who call themselves physicians treat pain, that that's a normal part of medical practice. Well, what happened was, really, just about after 9/11, the federal government started cracking down on physicians that actually did that, that took the government up, and the FDA had called for pain treatment, and many people, Health and Human Services, And so the doctors were doing it. And when they were doing it, they became victims of the Drug Enforcement Administration. What happened was they would send in decoys, fake patients. They would find, go through people's pharmacy records and find any vulnerable people in there, any book of ex-con or something like that, put them up against a bunch of years and, you know, of time, and suggest that if they would just simply turn and testify against their physician, then they would find themselves without any more legal problems. And so this sort of snitch-driven prosecution, which is everyone's familiar with in terms of the regular drug war, was transferred over to medical practice. And we have seen an absolute public health catastrophe that has resulted from this. It's a travesty, but it's an inevitability when, as a society, we've put the idea that we should be drug-free ahead of any notions of decency or civility. And so that's what we get.
Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
The seasonal movie It's a Wonderful Life includes the memorable line that every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings. In the upside-down world of Poppygate, every time another pound of pure white heroin is produced in U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, another two Americans get their wings clipped by drug war scissors. Since the U.S. invasion in 2001, Afghan heroin production has soared dramatically to historically unprecedented levels, about a million pounds in each of the last 2 years. Despite intensification of the domestic drug war, the Bush administration's response to Afghan heroin production has been to wink and look away. Estimating that there are 14 hits of heroin in a gram, then last year alone, U.S.-occupied Afghanistan produced and sold over 6 billion individual doses to consumers throughout the world, including children in your neighborhood. 6 billion hits of heroin. Near the end of the movie, the main character, George Bailey, exclaims, "Isn't it wonderful? I'm going to jail." Here's hoping that 2006 brings our real world George B., a.k.a. the 6 billion hit man, to the same bizarre conclusion. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
On September 16th, I invited long-term guest on the Drug Truth Network, the author of Why the Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It, a judicial indictment of the war on drugs, Superior Court Judge James P. Gray.
What we're doing now with our present drug policy is literally fueling children to join gangs and be part of the action. We're increasing crime. People don't realize this, but when we finally came to our senses and repealed alcohol prohibition, homicides went down nationwide 60% in 1 year. I'm convinced the same phenomenon will occur when we finally repeal drug prohibition. People also don't realize that almost literally every dollar we put into the prosecution of nonviolent drug offenders is a dollar we take away from the prosecution of violent offenses. So violence is flourishing mostly because of the fact that it's being fueled by drug money and we're not putting our resources where it will really help us. It goes on and on, you know, about the civil liberties disaster and about the exportation of all of this money that undercuts entire legitimate governments worldwide. It's just a disaster in the making.
Judge Gray, many people, like myself, and I'm sure thousands of others, have read your book and found a new focus and perhaps some new courage to take actions against the mechanisms of the drug war. I think perhaps foremost among that are members of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. There is a new wave on the horizon, is there not?
Well, I believe so. Again, I'm an optimist. I think that our people are beginning to understand the truth, which is, okay, yes, these are complex, gnarling issues, but it's okay to discuss drug policy. Dean, as you know, if we just get that fact across to our people and allow ourselves the ability to discuss this issue without feeling that we're caving in to allowing our children to take drugs, etc., which is certainly not true, we can just allow an open, full, and honest discussion. We will change away from our nation's drug policy because it's abundantly clear that not only it's not working, it's affirmatively harming us and particularly our children.
Next up, we hear from our October 7th program. Well, each week we dig a little deeper into this cesspool that they call a justice system here in the U.S., and this week I'm proud to have with us Mr. Jason Zeidenberg. He's the executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Justice Policy Institute. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you for having me on.
Jason, now tell us a bit about your organization, please.
The organization, the Justice Policy Institute, does research and communications work around promoting alternatives and looking at ways to end society's reliance on incarceration in the United States.
You guys, you have your eyes wide open. You see this problem. Tell us a bit about the work you're doing these days.
The biggest thing that we do as it impacts drug offenders and people that may or may not have a drug problem or people perceived by the justice system to have a drug problem is try to promote what's the best way to deal with people's issues. And we believe that there are people in this country for whom certain drugs are a problem for them in terms of some aspect of their life, and that problem doesn't need to be dealt with through the justice system. We also do believe that our response to drug policy shouldn't be done through the justice system. It could be done through the public health system, through the mental health system, through the education system, and that we're just investing too much money incarcerating people for too long for drug offenses. The organization has written about 10 publications that have looked at the impact of the overuse of incarceration on drug offenders, and several papers that have looked at what could communities do to reduce the number of people incarcerated for drug offenses.
The truth be told, if we didn't send so many of our young people to treatment for marijuana addiction, so to speak, we'd have beds open.
Yeah, that's a very complicated issue. JPI does not take a position in terms of whether we should legalize marijuana and what we should do with people that use marijuana. And I personally am kind of agnostic on it. It's, to me, it's certainly not the drug we should be focusing on in terms of what impact it has on communities. And the contrast that I've been trying to make around what we're doing in this country around marijuana is this. According to a Harvard University academic who studied the issue, we spend about $5 billion in this country on criminal justice responses to marijuana. That's police, prisons, and the justice system. We spend $16 million on new treatment for methamphetamines, which everyone says is the big new drug problem in the United States. Now, I don't even know if that's true, but I do know that there's probably a greater need for drug treatment for methamphetamine than $16 million worth of treatment versus $5 billion of criminal justice spending on marijuana. The other thing I would say about marijuana is we have looked at whether or not arresting people for marijuana has any impact on use. And basically, marijuana use rates rise and fall at their own measure and have nothing to do with the number of people that we arrest or incarcerate for marijuana offenses.
We're told by the media and the feds of the large number of methamphetamine cases in the social services system and of children being taken away from their families because of parental methamphetamine use. These concerns have been widely exploited by drug warriors in their push to enact tougher penalties and new laws against meth users. In Iowa, restrictions on cold medicines and other measures to protect agricultural chemicals from theft by meth producers have apparently succeeded in helping reduce the number of meth labs in the state. Data shows that Iowa's crackdown on meth has not reduced the reported number of child welfare cases involving parental meth use. That is, domestic production has decreased. Consumption, and particularly problem use, has not. We did see this coming. In 2003, a social services administrator in Iowa who researches this subject noted that the State Department of Human Services had found that what works best with meth-involved parents is often not available or available only on an unlimited basis. What works best is drug court, inpatient drug treatment followed by residential treatment, and intensive follow-up by trained substance abuse counselors. Treatment for meth addiction is a long-term proposition and may take several years for parents to successfully complete. The permanence and stability of children of meth-involved parents, in the meantime, remain a complex and costly dilemma. She was right then. The funding situation has grown worse since. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
And now this from our October 14th program.
Today, our guest will be Senator Pierre Claude Nolan. He is the chair of a Canadian Senate committee who issued a couple of reports about 2 years ago indicating that they wanted to regulate the distribution of marijuana and to change the policy of prohibition towards other drugs. He just returned from a trip to Kabul, Afghanistan, to attend an international symposium on drugs. And I want to welcome him to the show, Senator Pierre Claude Nolan. Welcome, sir.
Good afternoon, sir.
This change in policy seems to be taking place worldwide. People are beginning to look at the facts instead of the hysteria. Tell us quickly, if you will, about the report that your committee issued.
Well, it's basically a recognition that the war on drugs is not effective. We are recommending the change of the global paradigm because cannabis needs to be of a concern for the people, Canadians. But we need to change how do we approach the concern we have towards the substance. We came to the conclusion that it's not all use that should be of a concern to other than the user. The state should focus. When we use the word the state, it means the government need to focus on the abusive use of the substance, the dangerous use of it. Not the recreational use. But we need to prevent the excessive use of the substance, and we had various recommendations on how to change that approach from a criminal approach to a more public health concern.
Tell us about your trip to Kabul. What was that like?
Well, there was an international symposium on drugs. As you know, Afghanistan is the main producer, international producer of opiates. I should say illegal opiates. They are producing roughly 80, almost 90% of all the illegal opium around the world. And it's an illegal production. And it's totally in the end of the warlords and the traffickers. And it is also the most important business in the country. Almost 60% of the GDP of Afghanistan is under that item. What I am suggesting, and I'm not the only one, the Sandless Council, which is an international body who looks after the reform of drug policies, we came with a recommendation to start a feasibility study to transform the illegal crop of poppy into a legal crop of poppy.
On our October 21st program, we heard a report from our longtime reporter, Mr. Phil Smith, who does the cop stories for us, on his return from Kabul, Afghanistan.
I went out in eastern Nangarhar province, which is kind of a hairy place. When I went there, I had a driver and translator who had an AK-47 under the front seat. Fortunately, there was no occasion for us to have to pull it out from under the front seat. But that was Taliban country, and it was a little hairy. I went and talked to some opium farmers there, or more precisely, some former opium farmers. They had been growing poppies for the last several years, but last year the government came and tore them all out. So the farmers were a bit disgruntled since they had zero profit for their harvest last year. They also said that the government had promised them assistance, but it had never arrived. So the village elders, the village where I was, basically told me that the government are big liars. So they are unhappy. It was interesting. When I first started talking to these farmers, I asked them why they weren't growing opium, and they said it was because the government had asked them not to. But as the conversation continued, they became a little bit more forthcoming, and it became clear that they had not stopped growing opium out of a sense of civic duty, but came and chopped down their crops and left them penniless for the year.
these people in Afghanistan also do not have roads to get to markets. They, in fact, have no market for much other than opium, do they?
It's a brutal situation there, Dean. I've traveled a lot in Latin America, and I thought I had seen third world poverty and lack of infrastructure, and then I got to Afghanistan. When I went, I mentioned going to Nangarhar province. Well, the road from Kabul to Jalalabad, the big city there, is also the international highway that takes you from Afghanistan into Pakistan. It's a dirt road. It was paved 35 years ago, before they had 3 decades of civil war and Soviet invasion and more civil war and U.S. invasion and more war. And that's one of the good roads. The best road in the country goes from Kabul to Kandahar, but no one wants to go on that road because that's Taliban country down there. Getting crops to market is a severe problem throughout the country. You got to understand, this is a very rugged country. Two-thirds of it are above 5,000 feet. Only 10% of it is actually arable agricultural land. When you come flying into Afghanistan, it looks like a giant mud ball. They have huge mountains with no trees on them. There are miles and miles of deserts. As I said, very little arable agricultural territory. The infrastructure is just terrible. In the capital city itself, Kabul, a city of 3 million people, they can't keep the lights on. Electricity was out probably 50% of the time, the entire time I was there.
On November 4th, we reported on the Illicit Drugs Burden and Policy Conference presented by the City of Hartford, Connecticut, hosted by Trinity College and sponsored by Aetna Foundation. Speaking at that conference was our good friend, the Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, Mr. Jack Cole.
The incarceration rate that was mentioned earlier, 726 human beings for every 100,000 population in this country, is just the top of the iceberg here. If you scratch that number a little bit and look underneath, you find this terrible disparity by race. White males are incarcerated in this country today at a rate of 717 per 100,000. Hispanic males are incarcerated at a rate of over 1,200 per 100,000. And black males, well, before I get to what black males are incarcerated at today in this country, let me tell you what they were incarcerated at in South Africa under apartheid in 1993. 859 black males per 100,000 were in prison. In the United States, under drug prohibition in the year 2004, 4,919 black males per 100,000 were in prison. When I hear stuff like that, I can barely stand it. We've got to change this stuff. We have to end this. And there are ways to end it that will really work. If we were to legalize drugs today, just like we legalized alcohol in 1933, overnight we would put all those drug dealers and terrorists out of business. Just like we put Al Capone and all his smuggling cronies out of business. And then if we had the government or some entity produce those drugs and quality control them so that people knew what they were taking, we could end overdoses. Because people don't overdose on drugs because they shoot more and more dope every day in some crazy attempt to get higher and higher. They overdose because they get what's known on the street as a hot shot, which simply means they don't know how much of that powder they're buying is the real, really the dope, and how much of it is a cutting agent. It's impossible to determine that. When I started buying drugs on the street, heroin on the street, in 1970, it cost $6 for the average user to get high one time. And the heroin that was coming in on the street, according to all of our stats, was 1.5% pure. Now, according to DEA stats, 10 years into the war on drugs, that purity level had more than doubled. And the price had already dipped to $3.90 to get high. DEA has kindly adjusted these prices back over a 20-year period, back to $1980, so you can compare them. And by 1999, 30 years into the war on drugs, the price to get high had dropped, had plummeted to 80 cents in 1980 equivalent dollars. And the reason it was so cheap to get high by 1999 was the purity level of the drugs in that year were coming in street level, 38% pure. Last year, on both coasts, in New York and Los Angeles, street level heroin was coming in at over 60% pure. That's why we're having so many overdoses. We're losing this war. We've been losing this war since it started. And we're not suggesting, us in drug policy, we're not for a moment suggesting that we give up, quit fighting. We're suggesting that we look at this from a different angle.
On November 25th, we began our coverage of the Drug Policy Alliance Conference in Long Beach. From the British drug reform organization Transform, this is Danny Kuschlik.
That legalization is a process, not an outcome. And it said something that only became clear to me a little while ago. We're a campaign for the control and regulation of drugs, not a campaign for legalization. What we want to see is currently prohibited drugs legally controlled and regulated. Now, the process by which we get there happens to be legalization. But that's an ideological position. So we're not ideologues. What we're out for is a better world where drugs are controlled and regulated, not one where we win arguments and can champion a cause and say the L word when and where we want. This is about making the world a better place in which to live.
On December 16th, our guest was reporter for the Wall Street Journal, The Guardian out of the UK, and most recently for his reporting in the Texas Observer, Mr. Frank Smyth.
Well, you know, I don't think it's in any politician's interest to address a problem that he or she cannot resolve. I think this is the basic problem. I think there's an increasing awareness on an intellectual level that the war on drugs is an unwinnable contest at the very least, and that there needs to be a different kind of approach. But it's going to take a while, and I think you also have to recognize the massive criminality that operates in places like Nuevo Laredo and other parts of the Texan-Mexican border, and in countries like Guatemala and in countries like Colombia, that this poses a problem beyond just the war on drugs, but to the civil society itself, and that has to be dealt with. I mean, in Guatemala, you have a situation where the military has long enjoyed impunity for the worst aggregate human rights abuses to have occurred during the Cold War anywhere in Latin America. No officer has ever been prosecuted for any Cold War era abuse. But this impunity has now carried over into drug trafficking. The human rights community in Guatemala would like to see these retired officers prosecuted for their human rights abuses, both past and ongoing. But the problem is that they're not being prosecuted for any crime, whether it's murders of civil society leaders, past massacres of or destruction of wholesale destruction of villages, or organized crimes that they're carrying out today. They just enjoy blanket impunity.
I didn't do it. It was broke when I got here. It's not my fault. It's his. That is what makes the drug war work so well. I hope you've enjoyed this special edition of Century of Lies and that you'll join us next week when we'll focus on the exit strategy on the war on drugs. We have been duped. The drug lords truly run both sides of this equation. If it's ever to end, my friends, it's going to be up to you and your courage to speak the truth. Prohibido, Istak, Ivalesco. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Guffey.